last year college.
Coverdale?
Yeah.
My brother's up and down there a whole lot, working with scholarship programs, sending kids off to school from the area.
Yes, this last LP, Blues and the Soulful Truth, appears to have like more R&B kind of things happening, whereas your other recordings were more into the mainstream jazz thing. Is that, you know, some sort of, is that your direction that you're into, or, you know, you rap about that?
Well, I'm in a spiral that is...
Direction is always toward the people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best direction. I myself, not knocking labels and everything, I try to defy categorization. Not for purpose, but merely because of the background which I come from, which deals with all the music. You know, it's hard to say whether it's R&B or what. See, because I started off listening to Blind Lemon Jefferson. And when I first started singing, I was singing around the corner from Gate Moth Brown and them kind of cats. And I used to go and hear them dudes, you know, Chuck Berry and Lou Milton. In fact, Lou Milton was working on a Wednesday night and we were working on Sundays at the same club. But at that time, I was with Grant Green and Jimmy Forrest. I was in junior high school. But B.B. King, I used to scale a 3-story building to get in free to see him. And cats like Leo Gooden, Charles Williams, who's a professional now. We were working like after football games in East St. Louis together, you know. And there was a guy named Dave Thomas. There was a guy named Ted Weems. Tab Smith, worked with him. And the cat that originated the Lyle Hampton routine, Ben Thigpen. You know, he was a drummer with Lyle Hampton. Well, Lyle Hampton was famous for him. He was the cat that started the sticks for the shit. And Ed Thigpen Jr. is his nephew. And he has a son called Ben Sid Thigpen, who's the third of Thigpen, who's drumming around St. Louis. Now it's fantastic. He's a little too far out for me right now because he doesn't emphasize the steadiness. He wants to float. And it's like, man, I sing it all, and I sing it all. But for purposes of identification, I don't know what you could call it. I call it just people music.
It's basically how you create your music to, you know, to the people, a person, yeah. Not necessarily.
I found out that I was attracting one proportion of people as opposed to the other, and not wanting to alienate anybody. So to speak, I just went back to the roots and started all over again. Because they always told me that I could never sing that type of music until at first. They said, first you got to sing what the people want, and then you'll be able to sing what you want. So that stuff you sing is too way out. So I said, are you kidding? I said, I can record what I want to record. So that was 7 songs that I always want to do all my life. It's what I did on my first album. They said I couldn't do it. I did it. So then the next time they said, well, man, you can't do a tune on the whole side. No vocalist has ever done that. I said, I'm going to do that. So we did Journey on the whole side or whatever. And everything they said, you know, like my son didn't crawl. So I know you don't have to crawl before you walk. All those type adages, you know, I don't know where they come from. But I always liked the blues. We did a little blues with Johnny Hodges, just a little, on that Three Shades of Blue. And I always had C.C. Wright in my repertoire, so I decided to do those type things. And the tune China Doll came out of Clear Blue Sky along with Let's Go Down to Lucy's, because we were trying to find something to do, collaboration with Pee Wee Ellis. He and I had been thinking about doing some ideas for years. And these were tunes we had laying around even before I began to record, you know.
Yeah, on the LP, on Pharoah Saunders LP, thing that he sort of the opening vocals so much of what you're doing. He does on Japan. A lot of people confuse the fact whether that's Leon.
Well, see, that album was
Pharoah.
After he had met me. See, what happened, I was in the West Coast when he recorded Tahid. Mm-hmm. And so he wasn't able to get in contact with me, so he went on to the record date. and did Japan. Well, see, I got words to the Japanese song. See, that's like I had
words. That's basically what I was going to ask you, is how closely related were you to that? Because it seems as though for a period of time, there was a lot of that kind of vocalization being done. I mean, maybe we first should talk about the kind of thing that you do. I mean, how was
I brought that to New York.
As far as, let's say, going, let's say, from scatting vocals. I mean, incorporating all these different pieces, because it's definitely unique.
Well, it's all throat articulation, you dig, and sound syncopation. I call it the solar phone. S-O-U-L-A-R, dealing with the solar forces and the soul. This way is the voice is the most evocative instrument you got, you know.
Most expressive, too.
Yes. So the idea of it is, if you're not hung up, you can do anything you need with your voice. And like it started off with us, my brother and myself, learning albums and cats run the pool and say, man, how did that Charlie Ventura album go, you know? They would actually ask how the album went, and so we'd do the album. You know, with our mouths, you dig? And to the point where we began to get the rhythms, and we wouldn't actually do the song, we'd just do the rhythm and try to see who could guess by the rhythm patterns what song it was, things like this. So we just compounded these ideas. And then my mother showed me some things to do with the bottle, like I do on Gypsy Queen. And I always had this thing in my throat, you know, able to do anything, you know. So what had happened, after hearing different country and westerns, and moving to New York and hearing Indonesian sounds, and what is that, around Turkey, and then going and listening to things from the Congo, I found out there's a sound that's more primordial than being limited to any locale, you see. And then I kind of found out that some of the most primitive peoples had used it as a form of worship, so to speak. You know, they call it a umbowite. And it's just overtones and breathing. And it has some yoga techniques in it that some people call mantras. But it's a primordial thing. You find all these people use these sounds in all different diversified places of the earth, but they use them for the same purpose, to express certain relations to natural phenomena. And by doing so, I found that I had a fusion of all these different things wound up in me, which is what the people in this country represent. Combination of all cultures, you see. And I was lucky enough to retain a stubbornness to let my voice teachers train it out. In fact, I stopped taking voice lessons because they all wanted me to do something else with this vibrato. They said, well, vibrato, you know, you can't control that much vibrato. So I went about to prove that I could control it. And just by people saying what I couldn't do, I found out they were telling me what to do, you dig? Subconsciously, I found myself, whatever they were telling me not to do was the most natural thing for me to do. And so somebody just told me, said, just keep on being natural. And I found I could create with it, and I could be spontaneous with it. So I just kept it in. And it really came back into being when I was singing with Basie. I had to sing every day all the time. So when we got to the point where he said, no, which is what Joe would say, I just slipped that vocal inflection in there, you know, and did it my way, you know. And so the first time they turned, you know, they didn't know what it was, you know, but it was still getting across within the blues, you know. So it can be used anywhere, but you got to know when not to use it, too. So that's the main thing. But I find there are tones I can control in it, but when I'm really breathing properly, and open up other channels in the respiratory system, there are tones that come in on their own that harmonize in and out dissonance and give like three tones, you know, which is like I'm controlling two or trying, but I don't know who or what the other is all about, you know, that's some other shit. So. And it comes and goes of its own violation, you know, I have no control over it. Now about that album, is this a different? I just think it's just a part, man, you know. Like, the more I record, the more diversified it'll be. I've never been able to stick to any one particular style. Like, in performance of the evening, I might do ballads, you know, blues. The reason I like to do the other things so much is because it's more demanding creatively, you know, to do things like that. And because with normal type singing, you stick to what's going on and what's expected. You sing the lyrics, and you don't try to create too much with it, you know, because you want to retain the flavor. But for creative exercise or tapestry of sound, you're trying to create on certain tunes, which some people call jazz, you know, or whatever. You know, it's you're given a little more leeway to do what you want to do, you know, as long as it's within taste and not too long and boring. So I don't, you know, I don't know what I'd be singing next. Maybe something with Ellington. Then maybe some gospel songs, you know, because I sing gospel music too. You know, I don't know where it all in. I sing country and western. I got country and western songs that I had written in 1953, you know, because I never did them. You know, I always had them.
And you always, you gonna do some on the next album?
Not the next album, but before I start recording, I'm gonna do everything except La Traviata.
Were there any of these things recorded other than your Flying Dutchman releases?
I mean, yeah, I recorded an album for RCA Victor in 1958. That's why I went to New York. I never found out the name of that album because they never released it. That album became, it's a mental blank. And it's a block there because I left school my junior year and I came up to New York with this contract for RCA Victor because I needed to make some money. Some problems at home and everything, so I came to make this fast money to get what was happening. Everybody was telling me that, you know, nobody's doing that. You ought to be in New York, you know. In high school, they used to call me Mr. Modern for the type of music I was singing. And this disc jockey, Spider Burks, at home coined that name for me when I was doing a live broadcast on his jazz programs. The next thing happened was that I went out of school, ran to Hank Crawford and those guys. And we began to work in a club called New Era. And the guys would come through and say, man, you know, you really ought to be in New York. So finally one sent for me, and it was Faye Adams. She had taken some things up of mine, and RCA was interested. She was my manager. We went in and recorded a whole album with 18 pieces, strings included, and Ada DeRay Charles singers. And the album was fantastic, and they claimed that the people weren't ready for the music. So they put it on the shelf. So exactly 11 years later, I went in that same antiquated studio, four-track stereo separation on 34th Street, the old RCA Studios now, for Impulse Records with Pharoah Sanders. When we were supposed to do the new music, when we went on the most antiquated recording system possible. Same month, 11 years later, same place, same time. I did the same type of music again. And the album went up, Karma. And to show you how cycles go, you know, nothing had changed as far as I was concerned. You know, I always sang this way.
It's cosmic.
Huh?
It's cosmic.
Yeah, of course. Of course. But the thing about it, I wasn't discouraged in a lot of ways. I just wanted to retain it because I'd always want the admiration of musicians first, you know, because a lot of times it was hard to get on the bandstand being a singer. Uh-huh. So that's why I picked up the bongos and the kumbas and things like that, and I would play, and they see a rhythmic musical, awareness. And so as the night went on, then I finally, you know, cajoled them into letting me sing one. And then, I couldn't get back to my bongos then, you know. And they said, wow, yeah, you can sing, man. You know something? Yeah. And it wasn't long before that's how I began to get my work, you know, because I was there on a music and dramatic scholarship down at Tennessee State, but I wasn't going to classes because we'd have weekend gigs sometime that would last until next Tuesday, you know, up in Columbus, Ohio, and getting back from those places. You know, we invariably missed classes and the little job and chores that we were assigned in order to keep the scholarship. Solvent, we would farm out the cats and pay them for the money we were making on gigs, but they weren't doing the jobs. Mm-hmm. So for one, it messed up my scholarship in that area. So I went out for the track team, made the track team, and so I got another scholarship. And when baseball season came in, I would do that. basketball season going, I'd avoid the cut and get another scholarship and do anything to stay in school to stream on that music.
And execute at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and because the professors in the class, like Professor Brenton B. Banks, who's now the stream coordinator of all the recording sessions in Nashville, Tennessee, of all.
That's just a pretty interesting piano. Area, you know. How many musicians, other than quite a few musicians I'm sure that you know, actually have gone through a very, let's say, heavy schooling versus the amount of people who had it in them and have been able to get to it and present it more so than having it trained, you know, or what is that? What's a percentage?
You mean how many are heavily trained and how many found the training getting in their way?
No. We found the training getting in their way, but you know, there's a lot of musicians who have been able, the music is within them, okay, in the first
innately.
Uh-huh. And it comes out by their understanding of themselves more so than by classical music training.
How
important, you know, is that whole situation?
Well, for performance, I would say within certain areas of music, I found that guys, when you're gonna perform, if you're really gonna perform and be an individual in your performance, mm-hmm. then you have to create your own sound, and that you won't get out of any textbook. And so you get your own uniqueness from, as you mentioned, an innate quality, which is just there. You can embellish it, enhance it, you can edit it, you know, which is most times what you really have to do to make it palatable. But it's there, you know. But if you're gonna teach, or you go into a studio, or things of that nature, I find out that the guys who were destined to become great soloists, you know, like, what I would say, like Hank Crawford and, Les Mann had a great amount of schooling, but he's not too active anymore. Jimmy Cleveland went through that. He had a lot of schooling. I saw him today on the Merv Griffin show, mm-hmm. you know, but then still he may be one of the baddest trombonists in the country. You know, he's on a very good, but he had a lot of schooling. So it either conditions you to conform or
just
it prepares you to perform.
Tunes, that's all that happens. You just, when you get a classical training, you just learn the tunes, but you know better technically than somebody who's learned by himself.
Correct. Because it's a matter of reading the notes then.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to create the music, you...
What about Pharoah Sanders? He probably wasn't classically trained.
I don't know now. Pharoah played in marching bands and everything in high school. So I remember talking to him. Then he went to San Francisco, where he came under a lot of other influences. You know. And he went straight from high school into San Francisco. He didn't go to college, you know, where he began to play, you know, actively with guys like Monty Waters and who else was out there as a drummer. Wow, that old man's name. It's one of the baddest drummers I heard. He came and played with us a while when I was with Pharoah. I can't think of his name.
Earl, you need a ride?
He's a mean dude. Really play.
I'll do this.
But, now you take, I really listen to, so far as exploratory ideas, if I had to choose between, say, Oliver Nelson or Pharoah Sanders, maybe an Oliver Nelson or, say, Archie Shepp and Pharoah Sanders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a matter of taste. Though I would say I would get more of the unexpected out of Pharoah, even though there's a great virility in Shep's performance and a lot of facility in Nelson's performance. But for personal preference, I would rather hear Pharoah on certain tunes.
I really like that one cut on the Oliver Nelson in Berlin.
Berlin, yeah.
He plays some flute on there.
Incidental flute sounds. What do you call it? Obligatos. You know, and you know, just to add something to it.
There a solo at the end too?
Well, that's a Hindi way. That's the one note flute thing. You know, it's like with a bottle.
Uh-huh.
You know, you've seen that stuff before, haven't you?
It's just a wooden flute.
Well, it can be any kind of container. Keep knocking these things down. What is happening?
How did you like playing in Europe?
I found it a little more stimulating because of an awareness, seemingly. And we got a lot of press coverage. And I guess the greatest response I ever felt in my life was in Berlin, of all places. It was fantastic. They wouldn't stop applauding, man. And I went out and packed up all. I had a bag that I packed up every little instrumental piece of rhythm accoutrement that I had, which must have been about 50 pieces. You know, odds and ends, maybe somewhere in pairs. You know, maybe 25 sets of this or that. You know, and I picked up everything except this one little bamboo cylinder, which was a part of a flute from Ecuador, which is shaped like a xylophone, you know, the little, they all have their own notes, and it had this one note on it, something like, like that, and you just use your voice and this, and go from there. Yeah.
So that, you use that sort of like a drone?
Yeah, it was like, what do I do with it? Yeah. What the? Something like that. You know.
That's real nice.
You can do anything you want to do with that.
It's good with percussion.
Yeah.
Just that and percussion, and you have some beautiful music.
Yes, you must say they have.
A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people don't know that.
The Chinese even take it a bit further. They have a ceramic pots that are round, almost like this piece of, is that wax or what over there behind Deke?
I think it's a bowl.
A bowl, it's something like that. But it has a hole in the top, and it has little holes around the side, and you place your fingers over little holes, like so, two here, and you've got this little pot. And it's best to be played out of the corner of the mouth because you create the air flow. And just out of the corner of your mouth, just the barest insertion of air into this aperture, and you got a full pot, and you're changing this thing, and it's really fantastic. You know, but it's the same idea, but with them widening it, you know, and adding the holes in it, you know.
So we use a little bit like an ocarina.
Maybe. How do you get hip to all those different kinds of instruments?
People walk up and give them to me. Yeah, that's what happened with those. Don Cherry gave me one, and then the guy who made them found out that he had given them to me, so he brought me two. Let's see what happened with the other. The gongs from Pakistan, somebody walked up and gave me those. Some Baba lovers gave me a pair of tablas. You know, you go looking for things sometimes. I was looking for some bells, and chick walked up and gave me some Indian temple bells, you know. I said, wow. Okay.
You know? A lot of your instruments are gifts from your admirers.
Yeah, about a fourth of them anyway.
That's great.
Yeah. We take care of them. In fact, man, it was fantastic. We walk up on the bandstand, and you can't get to the bandstand. A lot of times down at when Pharaoh and I are together, they'd be all sitting around, you know, and it's, brought you some tablas, Leon. Brought you a gong, Pharaoh. And I said, oh, yeah. Look at it. You start playing and create a song right there on the moment. It was funny. It was too much. Yeah, man.
Do you go around to schools at all and demonstrate how to get into different kinds of instruments? Like Oliver Nelson does quite a bit, I think. He goes around and has all kinds of workshops at high schools.
Those things have to be set up. I've been trying to get into high schools. I was getting into them for a while with Jazz in Action in New York. They would have a series of things where they would send Benny Powell out with a group to a high school in the morning, and you perform to the junior high school in assembly, and you give them a little synopsis of music, and you give them a little synopsis of instrumental improvisation and whatnot. But I haven't been able to get into them like I want to. The things I like to do a lot of times is go in just by myself without any instruments, you know, and use the audience as an instrument. That's the big challenge, ECU.
How do you do that?
I'll show you sometime. You give me an audience.
We have one right now.
Yeah.
We got the thousands of listeners.
It's like a meditation. It's like a meditation thing. See, because I've been involved myself with, as we said, these. There are performances, and then there are rituals. And certain audiences you have to perform for, and then certain audience you find yourself able to do rituals. And if you got a hip audience, like we did some concerts up in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. We did a thing on a concert with Alice Coltrane. We would do anything we wanted to do. You know, I walked down the stage with her and whatnot. I did a talk up at the Rhode Island School of Design in Providence. And that was fantastic. They were so, it was like the School of Arts there. They came out and they sat around, you know, and we talked and they asked questions. And then I started these sounds, which aren't mantras, aren't chants. They're just universal, you know. Anybody can say, well, that sounds like Tibetan, that sounds like African, that sounds like Himalayan, that sounds like Swedish, or that sounds like Lithuanian. I said, well, yeah, good. You know, you know, because that's what you want. See, there's a basic song, you know, as a universal song that you try to get to.
Yeah.
That something everybody can
Ethiopian
sing.
Ethiopian music. You going to be in town tonight?
Where?
We're going to be playing some Ethiopian music on the radio.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, I listen to that. Yeah, I would listen to that. I would love to hear that. You wouldn't have any albums you want to give me, would you? No, of course not.
Sure.
Yeah, but you find...
What kind of music are you into?
That's obvious, ain't it?
All kinds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Listen to everything, man. Everything. But with that, working with kids, man, that's what I've really been trying to do. Like, you know, like these talks and different things like that, because you find the younger audiences are much more inhibited. Like, in
what
Detroit...
What would you say to an audience of young people? Because actually, there's one right here, right now.
Where?
Right out in the air.
In the air?
The people that are going to be listening to you talking.
But at the same time, I can't hear their response. See, that's what the audience is. I don't mean the invisible audience. See, they become a silent majority out there. I can't hear them.
They're out there.
They're out there somewhere. But actually, at a gathering where people come with one thing and purpose, you know, they can be unified even more so by what prevails in the way of music. And you try to, what I do is I give them certain sounds which relax everybody who wants to be relaxed. Certain sounds, certain rhythms, and then we all create. And then when they all create within their own little stuff, then I improvise something on top of it, you know. And pretty soon we're making music that everybody's a part of. It's a miracle to everybody. And it's there for the moment,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then you give them something to hum, and they usually leave with it, and they hum it all the way out the door. You know, you never end it. You never end it. It just, that's the way, just walk off stage, and they finally get the idea, and they walk on out, still humming. You know, it's beautiful. Because when you find, see, music is the first religion itself, because no matter what the service is or what the denomination is, what the expression, whether they worship fly specks, you know, on the back of mm-hmm. Big Mac trucks, you know, it's going to be a song. It's going to be a chant, you know, no matter what.
Sound.
Yes, you see, which is the whole idea. Because I guess you could say sound might be the womb of the psyche, so to speak, and you can envelop it and pass it on to the next cat, because it's been proven we can sing together whether we want to or not, but we can, you know, because everybody's singing everybody's music, mm-hmm. and everybody's playing the same music. So the idea of it is to bring the audience in so that you take the performance situation out of it. And if you get an audience actually a chance to participate with you, then you see there's no big thing about the separation of them paying for something that everybody's got. you know, you're feeding your own purpose in a way. So that's why I say sometimes you have to perform. But a lot of times you want to do rituals to bring people closer together, because actually you can survive off of, shall we say, communication of this sort, because it brings all diversified ideas into one idea. And that's where all ideas come from anyway, one thought and one purpose. And that's like life. You know?
That's one. Yeah.
Do the people come in and read music, or do they know what you're doing?
They know what I'm doing. They know what I'm doing. They do a bit of both. It depends on how new the music is, you know. But a lot of times, see, the best way to do it is to create the music and do it over and over, and then go in the studio and you do it that way. See, a lot of times you do stuff right for the studio, and then when you want to perform it in public, since the studio is the first time that you performed it, you know, you're really not accustomed to it. You're reading it, and then later on, the tune becomes more familiar with you, you know. But I think
you have to learn it from the studio performance.
Right, you know, when I think it should be the other way around. It should be the other way around, right. See, the studio should be the culmination of your efforts. If you're going to leave something that's worth recording, you know, which is, you know what a record is. A record is a monument to past events. Mm-hmm. I mean, actually, Alan.
Because the music's already been gotten together.
That's right, and it's over. That's right. It's over. So a lot of times you really have to have enthusiasm, see, because to hold the things together is a drag, because we got this 45. We were trying to do an album. Pee Wee Ellis and myself.
Was that China Down?
Yeah, we were trying to do an album, and we had all these tunes together. And we were rehearsing every day, listening to a lot of various ideas, new tunes, old tunes. And during the break of rehearsal, the cat got up, went over to the piano, the drummer, went over to the piano and just started tringing around with the bass line. Pee Wee heard him and said, "Hey, man, continue that bass line." And he went over and started playing some of the treble clef. And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, Leon," I said, "could you figure out where the one is on there?" I said, "Either one could start the figure, because one line was going against the other." I said, "There really is no one. It's a circle pattern." I said, "What I hear in there is like some lyrics. I said, turn the tape on." And it just flowed. We did it back, listened to it. I said, "Yeah, I know what I meant to say." So then I wrote down what I messed up. And it was just like a extemporaneous poem, you know, and it came through just like that. And we took this tape back to the guy, and he hurried up and got in the studio.
Yeah. Did you do much overdubbing or any at all?
A lot. See, that was a problem also, because certain units, we wanted to have certain horn sounds on it for the right guys to be in town. And then sometimes, see, Pee Wee has another group he works with. You might have heard some of their stuff, a group called Gotham. You probably, I guess I was wrong. They out of the Motown West situation, you know.
Yeah.
And they had an album called Bread, you know. And he was working with them a lot. And when I would be in town and the producer would be in town for the record, then the arranger was out of town. So I began to employ him so that I could keep him close to me and we could work out more ideas. And in the process of doing this, we stumbled up on a tune called Lucy's. I was talking about a young lady here in Chicago named Lucille, and we started to say, "Yeah, let's go down to Lucy's," you know. And it happened again. So then we had these two ideas, and the cat's still on one record. And by this time, China Dollars has a response, but there's no pursuit behind it, you know. And a year passed by damn near, you know. I mean, so far as the inception of the whole album, when he said, "Okay, that's it, go," it was a year. China Doll came about 4 months later. Then there was another 8 months behind that before the whole thing was released, you know, and that makes a total year, which had nothing to do with anybody's scheduling except the very obtuse operations of the producers, you know, which is understood only to them.
What's your relation like with your label, with Flying Dutchman? I mean, is it...
It's love.
Pretty much, you know, the same to do whatever you wish to do, or...
So far, but at the same time, I could appreciate a little more push, you know, a little more. That's why I'm here now, trying to see exactly what the indications are about certain new ideas that, so far the public concern, like what do they think of the album, you know, and things of that nature, and how the album's moving. Promotion.
They love it here. We always get people calling up once a year.
Well, but you don't know this. You see, you know, like I can listen to the people tell me that in the office and say, yeah, good. But it's good for me to hear, you know, because I like to know what's going on rather than reading an inventory sheet and seeing, you know, like figures and shit.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. Usually those inventory figures have a lot to do with the radio airplay.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, by being two of the most progressive shows in town,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's, if I play the album two, you know, if I mm-hmm. play China Doll, I had mm-hmm. a single since May,
mm-hmm.
I'm here two and three times in the show.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
and it still continues now that the mm-hmm. album's out. Now, maybe the period of time from when China Doll hit
initially
to when the album is, has been like a lag.
Sure.
But, I mean, it's good, man.
It's, it's all tying in now. Yeah, well, see, this is what I wanted to see for myself.
That's it, man. Yeah, I can tell you that that's happening.
Yeah, yeah, well, now that's why I'm here. See, this made my trip really wild. See, it would have been cold facts otherwise. Now I can feel another intimate, you know, situation. Because it made sense practically, because I was in the Midwest, and this is a major area, not Dayton per se, but so close to Chicago. Why not stop down and look around, you know?
We'd love to be able to bring you in to do concerts.
Okay? Love to be here. That's what
would
I do.
Be able to do maybe Eric Crown or Auditorium?
Easily. I mean, this is some of the things that, you know, we want to get into. I mean, it's really hard trying to get people here to Chicago because they have been here at one particular time and in space and have kept that same impression of Chicago with them.
Mm-hmm.
And things are happening here now.
Right. Sun Ra came back.
Yeah.
Sunrise
came here twice.
Well, I guess I can come now.
He ain't been here in 10 years.
Sonny Rollins right. is coming. Ahmed Jamal is here now. Okay, McCoy was here. Yeah.
Well, see, that's the whole idea.
Pharoah was here. It was his first performance in Chicago.
Right. See, which was weird because we were supposed to be in a hot group at that time, and we never worked Chicago. You know, and he's from Little Rock, Arkansas, and I'm from East St. Louis, Illinois. Both in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. Both got a lot of friends in Chicago. In fact, that's another thing. See, because a lot of this. People that were around when I was at Tennessee State are great proportion in this area. Not only that, the migration from the cast from East St. Louis who made it by coming to Chicago and the St. Louisans and all this, you see. I got family here and all like that. And the Midwest is, where is that anyway? If you don't, if you can't do anything in here, you know, then, see, this is just like going into a place and ordering grits and they don't have them.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah,
right. But you can get your grits in Chicago at all times, you see, and that's what I did. And, having been born in East St. Louis and raised in Columbus, Mississippi, and went to school in Nashville, Tennessee, you know, I can't be too urbanized anyway. And that city, I like to, you know, walk on a piece of ground every now and then, you know. New York, man. When I first got there, I used to see the little cats walking around with $30 pants on, $70 jackets, $15 hats, $20 shirts, and a pair of Converse All-Stars. And I never could understand why. Yeah. Or either the Bates Easy Floaters. These are the cats who were going out on dates, high school Sharpies and young college cats. And I used to wonder. And about 3 years there, man, it finally dawned on me. You know, all you're doing is hitting that concrete all the time. Never anything lightening up. You know, it's always clump, clump. It'll shake something loose in you. Women have female trouble. Guys have trouble being men. You understand? You know, because it just ain't there. That energy is, you know, is jarred all loose, you know, from that pound on the pavement, man, you know. And the kids play funny games. They don't know what mumbly peg is, you know. They don't know what marbles is. You know, they have a game called Scully, which explains the whole system in New York. You know, it's a square with numbered areas from 1 to 13. And it has the principle somewhat of a croquette because you can hit a guy or you can pass him up. So They put, it looks like hopscotch at first, is what I thought it was. And they put it right in the middle of the street, and the cars had to stop while the kids are down on their knees playing this game. They play with flat checkers or either the old cork filter bottle tops with the cork ripped off, something flat, so to speak. And they can lay down on the angle and thump these things shuffleboard style, amazingly and accurately, whereas the games don't end because we could all be playing. And I might owe you two hits, you might owe me two hits. And the idea is to keep, before I know it, you two guys may be playing together to keep me from getting to the top first in such a way that you're close to me and you're about to get out there, I hit you and you got to go back and do things like this. And it becomes like cutthroat, man. You know, to the point where as I working with street youth one summer, I saw the rain erase away the chalk mark. These people came and got there and played, man, without the squares being drawn. They knew exactly what their position were. They had zeroed in on this, which zeroes them in on a square when man comes from a circle. Mm-hmm. You dig, 1 of 13, and nobody ever gets there because everybody's knocking the other cat off.
It's a crab theory.
Yeah, you know, and it's weird, man. So they come up blocked in, you know, the cat in the next block doesn't know the cat. In this block, you know. If you can get out of the block, you cool, you know. And it becomes like, whereas we talk about neighborhoods, they talk about block associations, you know, because everybody's confined in one area of a high rise, you know, which may be going up to the sky, a block long, you know, and that's it. And it'd be million of people there, and all the kids are down in the street playing the Scully. And it gets involved with girlfriends, lunch money, everything, man. You know, and those games be going on till wee hours of night, man. They be down there, you know. And it gets serious. I mean, it's a serious little game. And all the people walking around and everything, and I was just caught dealing with the 10 to about 16 and dug the ones right under them that no one was paying attention to who were really hung up in the Scully, and then dug how these people approached Scully, their age too, when they played it, how serious it was, and it became quarters and... You know, Joey owed me three hits, you know, like, man, I'll let you out if, you know, and you blah, you know. I don't know what their stakes are, man, but I know if kids can't play on dirt, you dig, and they ain't got no circle thing going, you know, and the idea was to keep somebody from making it to the top. You see, it's dogs. So that's why the city becomes so hard, man, and nobody trusts anybody. You don't know who. You know, you gotta play a skull in. You get there and that's your man. You know, he gonna let you pass.
One of the few honest things that's going on is playing Scully. At least things come out in the open. People can relate.
But that's just it. They never come out in the open until your back is turned. Just like I was just making an example.
There's no open in Scully.
Yeah. You dig? So. That's right. See, what's happening is a square is sealed in. So the idea is, I think I'm home free and I don't realize I've forgotten that you my man every day. You're saying, I know you're gonna let me pass. But you might owe this cat three hits. Who's my enemy? You see? And he's willing to transfer the three hits and let you out. Whereas, you know, and the stakes is there, you know. And I don't even notice. This doesn't come out until I appeal to you, like when your shot comes, not to hit me. You dig? Mm-hmm. Just so I can get out. You dig? And you say, no, no. And this cat, and then you turn and look at him. Yeah. You turn and look at him. And he said, you say, oh man, what's happening? You know, did I give you the round the bike? You know, you see, yeah, man, but I owe this cat three over here. You know, what can I do? He say, hit you. And it's selling hits. This is what it's all. Now, understand that psych, selling hits. And that's what it comes to. Then
just
it goes.
Business world.
That's right.
You go from the Scully board to the New York Stock Exchange.
Right. And not only that. To the gang control, the territory. Mm-hmm. See, they got turf, man. Well, you wear that turf thing.
That's what it is. It sounds like an orientation to what's happening.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Because man cannot deal with the square too long. If you deal with the square too long, you're in trouble.
What's your theory about circle, the flow? Circular motion.
I think that's like holding hands. And the minute you stop holding hands, you square off. But as long as everybody holding hands and shaking hands, then the circle is complete, because it's reciprocity. I figure if there's no circle, then there's no use contributing. You know, but if I contribute, it's like casting bread on the waters and all the other thing, you know. It's like a universal concept. And I think anything that stops the circle is dangerous, you know. Any idea or concept. Because as long as the circle is there, then you got one person helping the other, you know. And that's more humanizing. Whereas when you become departmentalized, break the circle all up, then you got bureaucracy, red tape, you got... you got it, period. I don't need it. See, the circle is open too. It's free, man. It's a lot of space, 360 degrees.
How do you keep your own personal circle flowing? I mean, you're a man in the world. You probably have to deal with a lot of bureaucracies and red tapes. How do you keep your own circle flowing?
By setting my goal higher than what they think they're blocking me from. So what they consider an obstacle becomes only a hurdle after a while, because I ain't even shooting for that. But this play man Whitfield, slide on over. You know, here's a dealer, so that is zip. Right on over that boy. You know. Because everything out here, man, is fuel, you know. You know, because even when you're winning, you may be losing. You could be getting set up. You don't know. A lot of times, when you're putting your head against something, you may think it's defeat, but it could be, shall we say, a personification of all the things you believed in, just finally lumping up and trying to give you, what is it, not necessarily an ultimatum, but a showdown, you know. And if you believe in what you believe in, you go on through. And also, the spiritual forces which control everybody, you know, they deal in circles. You know, and if you really get hit to the circle, then you move on up to the one, see, because the circle becomes a spiral. And it goes on up, on up, on up to it. Becomes the one revolving around something else, you know.
You have any advice for people how to keep things flowing for them? How to keep the circle unbroken?
Go by the first mind. Always follow your first mind. I mean, anything you got to deliberate over ain't worth dealing with in the first place. That's all I know. You know, as opposed to instinct and intellect, you know. Because there's something highly intellectual about instinct, you know, but it's too deep for us to understand it. It's there. I couldn't explain it. Yeah, I got something. The number. What is it, that one?
The new one?
Yeah. I'm trying to think which tune it is. Oh, what sign? The number.
Oh, yeah.
Here
for some juice.
Yeah. One here, yeah. That's okay.
You want to play one of the tunes and talk about it?
Well, yeah. Now you talk about love each other is the answer. That's it. That's what I could. If you want any advice to keep the circle flowing,
yeah,
love each other. That's about the only thing I can say. That's it. Because man, if you love Jim. You may get knocked down, but there'll be somebody to pick you up. Wow, that's good.
Everybody got one?
One more.
Okay.
Step on new shoes, dear. Huh? Step on new shoes.
All right.
Ooh. Oh, Zodiac. We been taped now?
Yeah.
We said, well, this is DJ.
That's a real good laugh.
It's on the record, too.
Yeah.
There's a little tune in it.
Which kind of a laugh?
Shape your mind to die. Shape your mind to die.
Yeah, there's one thing that I wanted to know about your new album. It seems to be much, much funkier rhythmically than the other stuff that I've heard you do on record. Is that a change or just a going off into one vein for a while and coming back? Or is it, you feel yourself totally unlimited to anything you want to do?
Right, the latter.
That reinforces the most secular pattern, because that was the first question that I asked.
Yeah, circle right off.
So, here we have witness to the force of the circle.
Yeah.
Did you also ask Leon why he did that? Why he took that road?
Yeah.
He did. There really was no answer. It's just that I felt it was time to do it. You know. Because I want to do other things, too, if I keep on. I feel like, it's like a wedge, you know. You make the pinhole, and then you keep on adding other stuff onto it, and it keeps getting wider and wider and wider. And that's what's happening.
What's your next step going to be?
I don't know. I would hope Duke Ellington. I like to do a whole album with Duke Ellington stuff, you know. And then maybe maybe something like Imagining and as a tune called what is that tune? Oh yeah, we got some stuff that we're doing in the group too. Neil Cricky is very pianist. Prolific, yeah, composer, as he is a very good pianist. And we have a tune of his that we're doing now called Peace of Mind. I wrote some lyrics to. We got to get that on wax. I don't know what treatment we're going to give. I just like to do that live.
And when you cut the album, Blues and the Soulful Truth, as a get together, as a concept, were you aware of the commercial potential of it? I mean, do you think about that in... when you want to do an album, does, you know, like the thing is, well, if I do an album that has a broader kind of a spectrum, if I know this has a more commercially oriented thing, that it might help your thing at that particular time. Do you ever think of the commercial value of the kind of music you're doing? I mean, understanding you can do it all, okay, in different phases, but
yeah, that's a little bit different. I do, because I pray for the commercial value. it may not be my direct reason for doing it, but after I do it, I pray like heck that it's commercial and that they dig it, you know, because a lot of times selling love is the most uncommercial thing that you can do. Don't even talk about it in times where everybody's talking about something else, and it doesn't really make sense because you're swimming upstream, you know, but you do it anyway. And like a tune like CeCe Ryder or Gypsy Queen, you know, they were suggested by, Gypsy Queen was suggested by Bob. And I listened to it. I heard a lot of possibilities, but I didn't know there were lyrics to it. You know, just so happened he had some brand new lyrics to it. I said, well, yeah, we'll try it. And we listened to it, and we listened. And then finally we got the right ingredients, and we did two takes on it. You know, we started, actually one take, because we started one, and then we found out that one of the rhythm guys was missing. So we stopped, and he finally came back from the bathroom. So then we started again and let the tape run. And I think that's the longest cut on there, because the only spontaneous thing that the last thought was the fact on that overdub, we put some firecrackers on it to be reminiscent of a gypsy wedding, you know, where they're shooting the guns and stuff. You know? Because I went to see Gypsy Queen, you know, and we married, you know. So that was what that was all about. But I think that anything could be commercial if people could hear it the way that artist has in mind. See, if he has a lot of control over his stuff and does it the way he likes to do it, sure, he's not looking at the objective of the man who's trying to sell and trying to enter a certain market with an item. But I think there's a market for everything, really. It just depends on what the record company wants to expend in the way of promoting the idea. Because he can find a stream. It may not be a mainstream, but he can find something to subsist in. But then there are things that reach a great amount of people, whereas since the great amount of people of this, shall we say, situation that we're involved in this country, are always constantly on the move, so they don't have time to concentrate. So you want to get into something that makes them think they're really not moving in vain. You know, they're moving away out somewhere in the morning to work for some cat, then they're moving all the way back in the evening to work somebody, and during the time between they're working, which is why they went out in the first place, and the only time they have to themselves is in the bed, you know, so they can't listen to nothing then. And on the weekends, you know, they're going to try to make hay for all that. Well, not really make hay, because that's what they've been doing, pitching hay. They want to, what they want to do is get in there and find some way to throw away all the inhibitions for 2 days, Saturday and Sunday. Well, so let's say Friday and Saturday, because then Sunday, the greater proportion is in some type of service. And then the next thing they know, they back out to that thing again. So the music that you want for them is going to be quick around the news items, which lets them know what the expressway is doing that morning, and what the expressway is doing that evening, and what happened over the weekend while they were waking up over the hangover, so to speak. So what happens is it has to be quicker and grab them in such a way that it doesn't interfere with their train of thought, but still they can snap their fingers to it and say, yeah, that's all right. It ain't going to be so hard today. If I could hear this one more time, you know. So, since he doesn't have 7 minutes to spend getting into it, he shortened it and tried to condense it. Sometimes the ideas come quick, but sometimes ideas cannot be condensed.
And that's, a lot of good music can be put into 2 minutes.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff on the top sure board. Can. Right.
Your thing, I hope they play it on there. They should.
There's one on the album, which is, I think, even less than 3 minutes. Sure. Or I may be wrong. How long is L-O-V-E? L-O-V-E is just over 3 minutes, I believe. And that wasn't done for that purpose. It just, it was the tempo of the tune. 251. Yeah, you know. And I didn't try for that. In fact, I had that tune since 1955 in my head. That one particular tune, L-O-V-E. L-O-V-E. You know. And because I had a certain idea, see, where I was born there, on Missouri Avenue, there was, it was the first year after I was born. My brother was born in this house on Missouri Avenue, and he said, there were two railroad tracks. And naturally, being so close to these two railroad tracks, it would make certain things shake in the house. Mm-hmm. So you could determine which train or which track the train was on by which items in the house shook first. See? And which, and also which direction the train was going in. Mm-hmm. You know, and that became a fine art. Like, we'd be around the house playing and whatnot. And certain trains we'd like to go out and watch. Certain trains we'd like to go out and hop a ride on. We could even determine the speed of the approaching train, even in the house. To the point where, as on a railroad track, you go any direction. But say, for instance, you got two tracks going east and west parallel. Now, there's a number one track, there's a train going west. Number two track, there's a train going east. Then on one day, you might find both trains going east on the one and two. But the number two train may be approaching faster than the number one train. Well, there was like the cups would rattle for one thing, the glasses on the other side of the house or the kitchen would rattle for something else. Then you had we had a tub on the back porch that would rattle for something else. But of course, when the train was right abreast of the house, everything was rattling. But certain things began to rattle first. You see, so when I dug these two rhythms or these trains, you see, like it would be like playing against each other. When they were going different directions, you could really hear something. Like one train would just going in two different directions, and you hear this. And after a while, you know, I used to begin to make up little songs. Right. Make up little songs. And I found out I always made them up from the bass line to the top line. So that song L-O-V-E is reminiscent of that idea because there were two bass lines. And in performances, like I would usually use, we did that song first on a program with the Chambers Brothers and couldn't get off the bandstand. In fact, they couldn't get off.